The 21st century is when everything changes. And you've got to be ready.
Catapult the propaganda. The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
The highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody. Welcome to March the 16th, Sunday, one day shy of St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, and a day after the Ides of March.
It's an interesting time. You know, what about St. Patrick's Day, though, seriously? For years, I have been seeing 317 over and over and over again.
Really?
And I still don't really know what it is. I don't know if any of you out there have ever experienced something like that, where I know, in fact, I get emails from people who see 11s all the time.
Right.
Like they'll see 11:11 or doubling. Like they'll see the time will be 12:12. Or 0202 or things like that. I see 317 all the time. And the curious thing about that is that you and I have now moved to an area where the area code is 317.
Yes,
and I don't know if that's in any way connected to 317, but of course tomorrow is St. Paddy's Day.
Yeah, and traditions have been built upon the work of St. Patrick, who is probably nothing like what most people believe he is.
No, probably not.
The wearing of the green is more of an American invention than it ever was an Irish, an authentic Irish tradition, at least as far as I know.
Well, we'll find out.
That might just be what they want us to think. Anyway.
I know. Well, we're not going to go into that today, but we're going to – scheduled Dr. Jerome Corsi to join us this evening. He has asked us to please reschedule that for Thursday evening because he's going to spend some time with his family, and I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, he's been a busy man, and we'll talk about why he's been so busy in just a little bit, but we'll have that for you next Friday as we prepare for Easter or Resurrection Sunday, if you prefer.
Mm-hmm. That's what
we'll
I like to call it.
Yeah, next week's show posted a little bit early, and we'll talk with Dr. Corsi about his interesting couple of weeks. It's been about a month, well, 5 weeks since we talked with him last, and things have just been moving faster and faster. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight is based on the articles he's been writing and posting at WorldNet Daily over the last few weeks.
There have been so many things, and you and I have not had an opportunity to really just talk about the news for a while. Our traditional blathers
yes.
have had to go by the wayside because we've had these amazing guests, and I love having guests, but, you know, there's nothing like a good blather sometime. And
yes.
you know, just out of curiosity, I went to dictionary.com and looked up blather, and it's apparently based on an old Scandinavian word. It's a word used in old Scotland. And it means talker of blatant nonsense.
Which is what most of the world thinks we do. So it's very appropriate.
Actually. I don't know why they say that. And don't you love my little tinfoil hat? Hey, speaking of tinfoil hats.
Yeah.
Metals are going through the roof. They're skyrocketing. That's one of the stories that we need to talk about.
Well, as somebody who's now in the metal business once again.
Yes, man of steel.
The cost of metal, the price of metal, is something that we pay attention to as a company very closely. We get updates very, you know, daily on changes taking place because as someone who sells metals in various forms, we have to be able to account for upcoming price increases when we're quoting material for delivery that's more than a week or two in advance.
And it's almost daily.
And it's almost daily. And we've been watching the price of nickel, which has been affected by a variety of things. Now, first and foremost, the value of the dollar. And we'll get into that a little bit. But the price of nickel has been increasing. It was also affected by a mine strike in miner strike in Canada, which drove the price up a bit. Copper is going up. Even the price of just scrap steel is going crazy. Mm-hmm.
Chinese keep buying all the old cars.
That is correct. And we're finding as American consumers that our prices are impacted once again by what's happening overseas. Scrap steel is an integral component to new steel. You know, a good portion of the material coming off of the mills in the form of H-beams and I-beams and plate and so forth, the basic raw materials we use to build things in this country, is comprised of crushed and shredded cars. you know, stuff that is being recycled. Well, that scrap steel is also being used by foreign steel mills to produce steel. And the Chinese and the Indians are buying up material like crazy.
Well, it isn't just steel. I mean, there are metals all over the place that are copper and magnesium and zinc and, oh gosh, you can name almost any metal on the chart.
Molybdenum. Yeah, there are a lot of, you know, a lot of metals that are used for a variety of
industrial. They go into electronics.
Sure. When that's when you start getting into things like platinum and gold and other things. And palladium, they're all going through the roof, partly, again, because of the demand coming out of the Far East. The Asians are using up steel and other metals for construction at such a rapid pace that American steel mills, the guys that produce the very basic building blocks of construction, like beams and plate, are finding that, number one, their scrap steel is going up in price because they have to compete with the Chinese for the scrap they need just to make their steel. But secondly, if American distributors, like the company I work for, don't want to pay the price for the plate and the beam and the so forth, they can put it on a boat and send it to Shanghai because the Chinese will buy it. So American manufacturers and constructors are finding the cost of their raw materials increasing, not because the demand for their products or their buildings is increasing, but because the cost of their raw materials
right.
increasing.
So what you get is anything that's made from a metal these days is going to have to go up in price. The manufacturing cost of it is going up. And you found a really curious story about an item that we don't items that we don't think about every day, but they're probably in your pocket right now.
The cost of producing the coins that we carry around in our pocket because of A, the value of the metal, and B, the devaluation of the American dollar is at a point now where it costs about 9.7 cents to produce a nickel and about 2 cents to produce a penny. Now, pennies are primarily copper. Nickels are primarily nickel, well, zinc and nickel, but nickel's the primary component there. So those coins essentially contribute to the federal deficit.
Yeah.
Just by minting these coins, we are going further into debt because the cost of the material is more than what the coins are worth at face value. Now, pennies and nickels don't have any real numismatic value. In other words, they're not collectibles. So you can't take a penny off the right out of the mint, turn it around, and sell it for more than a cent. No one would buy it.
Well, really old ones you can.
What I'm saying is the new ones coming right off the mill.
Right.
Yeah, you cannot sell those for more. There's no numismatic value. However, the value of the copper in the penny now, and I think it's very significant that last year in 2007, the U.S. Treasury issued a warning that there would be severe penalties, legal penalties to be paid if anyone were caught melting down American coinage for their base metals, for the component metals. And we're seeing stories from around the country of job sites being raided for copper. You know, wires are being taken from construction sites. And I think it's very interesting.
Schools, high schools, you know, ripped right out of their electric boxes, and they can't have their games at night, the football games. I remember last fall there were a number of football games that were canceled.
Yeah, it's a very interesting situation that we're in. And again, much of it boils back down to the fact that the American dollar is really tanking.
Well, Congress has stepped in. There is a bill that was introduced in the House on February 28th, 2008, this year, and it's called the Coin Modernization and Taxpayer Savings Act of 2008. That's right. And the proposition in this bill is that these coins, nickels and dimes and pennies, be made from steel, but be made to look as if they're still made from nickel or copper, or, you know, in other words, they're supposed to look the same and weigh the same, so they still work in coin-operated machines.
Yeah. And the reason they want to make them look like the old coins is because the last thing they want is people actually asking questions. Hey, why is my penny now gray or silver instead of the old copper color?
Well, I think what's so funny is that they want to make them from steel. I'm thinking, have they looked at the price of steel lately?
Yeah. Well, it's still low enough that they can get away with it. Steel has increased substantially in price. I will say this. It's up, gosh, oh, it's up nearly 25% in cost since the beginning of December.
Well, but my question is, isn't steel magnetic, some of it?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, unless it's stainless.
Do you want a magnetic coin? I don't know. Are coins magnetic now?
Most of them are not. But, yeah, if they're made from steel, unless there's certain grades of stainless steel. In other words, if they've been alloyed with rather expensive materials like chromium and nickel, mm-hmm. Which gets back to the whole problem of the coin being worth more mm-hmm. as the melted metal as it is at face value. Well, that'll be interesting to see how that goes. But
well, I think that's really interesting, too, because you and I have talked in the past about the fact, and I believe it really is a fact, it's just not happened yet, that the United States is going to go eventually on a different standard. I really think in the next 5 to 10 years you're going to see us go off the dollar standard. And again, this is if Jesus Christ did not return first. And I say that laughingly because, truthfully, the thought of Jesus Christ returning is a joyful, you know.
Yes.
Event to ponder, but if for some reason we're still here in 5 to 10 years, we're going to see, I believe, a move over to the Amero or something like it.
And this gets back to the conversation that we had last month with Dr. Jerome Corsi, and we will likely continue when we talk with him on Thursday night. And if you've not listened to that old interview, I recommend that you do it.
Well, he just recently went to a different conference. Well, he went to one conference he was able to attend and write about, and the other one he actually was kicked out. But you can tell that story, and then we'll get more details from him on Thursday.
Right. His contention is that none of this that's happening with the U.S. dollar and its and the correlating evidence that we see. By the way, as we record this on Sunday evening, the news coming out over the weekend is that the investment bank Bear Stearns may likely just have a turn out the lights party tomorrow, Monday, mm-hmm. even though it's supposedly...
Yeah, bank holiday rumors are all over the place.
Right. Even though it was supposedly saved by the Fed, along with J.P. Morgan Chase on Friday, mm-hmm. the fact is that Bear Stearns is far from saved at this point.
Yeah,
and we'll talk about that.
I think the stock market could well just take such a nosedive tomorrow.
Right. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But again, Dr. Corsi believes that none of this is by accident, that the United States dollar has been artificially inflated by the Federal Reserve, knowingly, intentionally. And I think he's got a point. I mean, first of all, we have to step back and say, is it possible, is it conceivable that Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, the guys who've chaired the Fed since the late 1980s, are really so incompetent and so stupid that they didn't know that running up the supply of money in circulation, especially over the last 2 years, at an average rate of annual rate of over 15%, mm-hmm. wouldn't cause the value to drop. I mean, any freshman student of macroeconomics 101 knows mm-hmm. the basic law of supply and demand. If you have more of something in supply, the demand drops, and thus the value for that item drops. The dollar is essentially a commodity mm-hmm. because it's not backed by any precious metals. So when you're talking about U.S. dollars, you might as well be talking about, I mean, its value is what people believe its value mm-hmm. is. In other words, you might as well be using credit cards, mm-hmm. I mean, not credit cards, rather, baseball cards as a means of currency.
Yes, or turnips.
Or turnips. Yeah, it's whatever you believe the turnips are worth. That's their value in form of exchange. So the last couple of years especially, and I direct you to a website called shadowstats.com, run by a man named John Williams, who has basically compiled statistics that the Federal Reserve and at the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the United States have been fabricating over the last few years. He basically has gone back and recalculated what the money supply actually is. He's calculated the rate of inflation based on the formula used by the U.S. government prior to 1980. And he finds that the rate of inflation, which anyone who has to shop for a family knows, has been running at over 10% for the last mm-hmm. few years, that the supply of money in circulation has been increasing by 15 to 17% a year, and that all of this is by design, according to Dr. Corsi. Why would they do this? Why would they deliberately trash the U.S. dollar? Because they have to create a crisis in order to force the average American to believe that we need to go to a regional currency. Mm-hmm. We need to go to a regional currency, whether it's the Amero or whatever they call it. That is the plan.
It may not even be a physical note that you hold in your pocket. Mm-hmm. In other words, the bank, the dollars that we have, they're really nothing more than notes.
Right.
You know, saying that I owe you X amount of money, and this is something to hold on to that represents those goods. I think it's going to be something like, we'll give you so many credits.
Mm-hmm.
in your bank account. I really do think that eventually and very, very quickly that all Americans will be switched over to using debit cards.
And all of our money will be just be electronic.
Exactly.
Which again is...
So you don't have to call it anything. It could be whatever.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
long as... And I really do think that we're going to see a move toward the transatlantic entity along with the North American Union all using the same EU, Euro, whatever you want to call it.
Quatloos.
Quatloos.
A little Star Trek reference.
I'll bet 40 Quatloos on the newcomer.
So now, Dr. Corsi was at a meeting on Monday, and this is what Sharon mentioned earlier, that was largely didn't make the press, really. In fact, the only press account that we've seen of this meeting was the one that was published at WorldNet Daily by Dr. Corsi. It was held at the Department of State, the offices of the U.S. State Department, under what are called Chatham House rules. Those were developed in the U.K. at a place called Chatham House. Basically, what that means is reporters are allowed to attend the meeting as long as they don't attribute any specific quotes to any of the attendees. So while you can report on what was said at the meeting, you can't say who said what. So there's no real accountability. Anybody can say whatever they want because the reporters there have agreed not to hold them accountable for it. Now, what was discussed at this meeting? It was a meeting of the Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy. This is a group that is guiding the Department of State on how to move forward with integration and harmonization between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, the North American Union. But they're already looking beyond the North American Union. According to Jerry Corsi, the meeting, which was opened by Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Sullivan and the chairman of this ACIEP, Michael Gadbaugh, they're talking now about a transatlantic economic community, or a TEC, a U.S.-EU transatlantic economic council. Now, what is the TEC? It sounds to me, and it sounds to Dr. Corsi, who was at the meeting, as though it's the preliminary steps to forming a transatlantic union, beginning with economics, which is how the European Union started, as the European economic market, or the European common market. They talked about harmonizing trade guidelines, administrative rules and regulations, and things like that. These are the sorts of things that used to be called treaties.
Yes.
Which, according to the United States Constitution, required the advice and consent. That's the key word, consent. The United States Senate has to approve any treaty entered into by the President of the United States. This president, this administration, has skirted that little requirement.
By calling them things like initiatives.
Yeah.
Or agreement.
The Security and Prosperity Partnership. Hey, we're simply harmonizing our safety guidelines. We're harmonizing our labor regulations and things of that
this
nature.
This is a de facto world government that is being slowly put together.
The SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, now has 20 trilateral working groups inside the governments of the United States, Canada, and Mexico that are getting together and working on hammering out mutually acceptable terms for a variety of things involving trade. And again, these are the sorts of things that used to be drawn up in the forms of treaties, which, again, according to the U.S. Constitution, has to be approved by Congress before it can go into law. Under the Bush administration, just by calling it, you know, harmonization, convergence of administrative rules, you know, nice little euphemisms like that, they get around the constitutional requirement of having to get a vote, putting it before Congress for a vote. This is, you know, bad. This is outrageous enough. But then when you understand that they're already looking beyond this NAU, is almost, you know, the NAU is already a, you know, what's the French term? Fait accompli. It's already done. We need to start looking at how we're going to integrate with the EU in order to maintain our competitive place in the world market. Now, why are we spending so much time? Why is this government spending so much time doing this and working on maintaining our economic standing in trade? Well, obviously, trade is important. We live in a global village, if you will. But the people who are counseling this administration on how to go about doing this, not members of Congress. I mean, forget about even, you know, for, you know, getting beyond the boat, they're not even including members of Congress on these advisory committees. This ACIEP includes representatives from General Electric, ExxonMobil, J.P. Morgan Chase, Archer Daniels Midland, UPS, Citibank, Procter & Gamble, Hunt Oil, you know, Lamar Hunt and, mm-hmm. and those ways, mm-hmm. Boeing, 3M, Goldman Sachs, Cargill, and CMS Energy.
Well, I would argue that the members of Congress are simply too busy renaming post offices.
That's very possible.
To consider things like
very
this.
Possible.
I mean, if you ever take a look at, and I wrote a piece about this a couple of weeks ago. If you ever go to thomas.loc.gov, which is where you can take a look at what Congress is doing, that's how I found this bill about the coinage, you would be shocked to see what drivel goes through their hands yeah. every day, what nonsensical waste of time these people are involved in.
Yeah, it's... So because they've got all of those important things, like, you know, days to honor certain people in hometowns back in their districts and renaming post offices in honor of wealthy contributors or what have you,
mm-hmm.
Things like the Security and Prosperity Partnership, which members of Congress, many members of Congress aren't even aware of, even to this day, I would argue. Those who do know about it were alerted to it by people like Jerry Corsi
mm-hmm.
just within the last 18 months. You know, this is a Congress that didn't even notice until... 2006, that President Bush had issued dozens of signing statements to effectively
mm-hmm.
get around portions of bills that he didn't agree with.
And I would venture to say that they've not looked at the executive orders for the last 20 or 30 years, because an executive order goes through, I think it's a 60-day vetting process that has to be published in the mm-hmm. congressional, what's the Hill? Maybe it's just called the Hill.
Congressional record?
It has to be published. And, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the Vaughan Treaty thing.
Oh, yeah.
has to be on display at the planning office.
Fourth sub-basement.
And yeah. Congress has, I think it's 60 days or 30 days in order to say to the president, no, we don't like this. We believe that this executive order is contrary to XYZ law or whatever, and you can't have this.
Mm-hmm.
If they say nothing, it becomes law automatically. Mm-hmm. Well, I think only once or twice has Congress ever done anything about executive orders. They just automatically become law. That makes the president a king, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and this was something that conservatives screamed about during the Clinton administration when Paul Begala, who's a mm-hmm. regular contributor to CNN now as a political analyst, said, he uttered the famous line, stroke of the pen, law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
Yes.
That's a king.
And that's what these signing statements are.
Exactly.
It's like a king coming along saying, well, you nice people over there, you feel free to enact whatever law you want, and I'll sign it, but I'm going to make this statement to go along with it.
And if you think that this is something that is unique to the Bush administration, think again, because of until Mike Huckabee dropped out, the four primary candidates for president were asked about the presidential signing statement, and three of the four, Obama, Clinton, and McCain
mm-hmm.
said that they would continue to use the signing statement
mm-hmm.
in order to clarify the president's position on certain bills. So don't expect this to stop anytime soon. In fact, I would suggest this is the reason that the Democrats, who control Congress, the legislative branch, which should be operating as a check on the power of the executive
mm-hmm.
branch of government, the reason they haven't raised a stink about this is because they're just waiting for their turn at the levers.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, I would argue that there really is no difference between the Republican and the Democratic parties at the national level. They are simply presented to us as alternatives
mm-hmm.
when, in fact, they are essentially just different wings of the same war party.
They are two different heads of the same bird.
Yes. A phoenix, perhaps.
The phoenix,
yeah.
Indeed.
So we've got the Security and Prosperity Partnership, which is, again, being knitted together without input from Congress, but with input from Ford, General Motors, Merck, Chevron, General Electric, Walmart, Lockheed Martin, the Kansas City Southern, which is the NAFTA railroad, Campbell Soup, Gillette, Whirlpool, New York Life, Suncor Energy, which is a huge energy concern up in Canada,
mm-hmm.
Bell Canada, Home Depot, based out of Canada, and a number of other companies out of Mexico as well. And then, we get back to the other group, the ACIEP group, which is advising the State Department on the Transatlantic Economic Council.
Mm-hmm.
Again, being all of these multinational corporations.
Well, I would say by partnering with Canada in the first place, we have, in essence, partnered with Great Britain, because Canada is not Is it not still?
It's still technically
part of the United Kingdom.
Queen Elizabeth. I don't know that it's technically part of the United Kingdom, but Queen Elizabeth is still considered the sovereign of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, Canadians, I think, would be uncomfortable with that, but
especially those French Canadians.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. The Quebecers or Quebecois, they probably don't like to hear that. But technically speaking, they are still subject to the rule of the British Crown. So what have we got here? I think, again, we've got more evidence that indicates that United States economic and foreign policy is being dictated to us by these oligarchs, by the multinational corporations. Mm-hmm. They are driving our economic policy, which is to devalue the dollar. Why? Well, for one thing, to encourage us to adopt a regional currency, and perhaps not just a North American currency, but an EU, as you mentioned, a North American, Western European currency. Secondly, I completely lost where I was going with that. I got so wrapped up in the currency.
It happens to the best of us. But you know what it boils down to is this whole dog and pony show of election is meaningless. It truly is just the real man behind the curtain is the SPP and the ACIEC and and the TEC and all of these letter organizations that that comprise this oligarchic beast government that's really running the show.
Well, that's ultimately what it boils down to. Stepping back and looking at this again, as we try to do in light of Scripture, is that what we are seeing is the evidence of a growing push to break down national sovereignty and accept a regional and then a transoceanic and then eventually a global government for our own good. Now, who really benefits? Well, it's the people who want to sell goods and services across borders. Mm-hmm. Because while all of these, the trade regulations keep coming up in these discussions, one thing that keeps getting mentioned is the free flow of labor across borders, which is why the southern border of the United States has not been shut down and will not be shut down. They don't want to shut it down because they want cheap labor to continue to flow into the United States. But again, this is all part and parcel of turning us into eventually subjects of a global one world government.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, being a member of the EU is not any kind of a picnic. There's a story that I posted just recently at peeringintodarkness.com that goes into the ratification process, sort of, of what amounts to a constitution. The only country within the EU that is complaining about this at all and really wants to have a referendum on it is Ireland.
Mm-hmm. You can't push the Irish into doing anything.
No. Trust me. I'm half Irish.
The Irish are a stubborn group, and we mean that lovingly, because if it weren't for the Scots-Irish here in the United States, I don't think we would have successfully carried out the American Revolution or a number of other wars. I mean, I firmly believe the Scots-Irish to be the real backbone and the heart of the United States. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out, because the UK, the United, Britain, England, the United Kingdom, members of parliament there voted to deny its citizens the right to vote on accepting the Treaty of Lisbon.
Yeah, exactly.
This would be like the United States Congress saying, we are going to vote on whether or not to join a North American Union, and we're not going to let the citizens of the U.S. vote.
Exactly. And here's why I brought this up when I did, because you mentioned labor. And there's a wonderful, there. In fact, if you even do Lisbon Treaty at YouTube, you're going to find a lot of short films about this. And there's one gentleman that I think comes from, gosh, I think he's from Sweden. And he was saying that the MEPs, the members who represent the European Parliament, have not even read the Lisbon Treaty because it is so weighty and so lengthy and so intentionally confusing in its language that it can't be read.
Sort of like the Patriot Act.
Very much like the Patriot Act. And essentially because of the language that's in there and those who have tried to dive in there and digest it and see what it really says, it is essentially going back to the old constitution of the EU that was voted down long ago And Angela Merkel, when she came into office as Chancellor of Germany, said she was going to make sure that the Constitution got a vote and was approved. Well, she's doing it by having the Lisbon Treaty go through and get that approved without anybody having a chance to even vote on it.
Yep. Well, it's happening in the UK and to the citizens of Europe, and it will likely happen
here in the
United
States. And it's happening to us
States.
Because we have nothing to say about it.
That's exactly
if
right.
If our elected representatives aren't in on it.
Yeah. I mean, because we can step back and say, look at what they're doing in the UK. Parliament isn't even going to let their citizens vote on essentially subverting English authority, English sovereignty mm-hmm. to an EU. But here in the United States, our Congress has not even been included in the discussions of the Security and Prosperity
well,
Partnership.
Well, we're led to believe that we have some sort of say.
Yeah.
You get to vote on, you know, in Ballot Bowl 08. The Ballot Bowl.
And, you know, things, talking about the election for a little bit, who would have thought at this point, you know, March of 2008, looking at where John McCain was last summer, that he would have been the Republican nominee for president? As, well, I think I've said this before, courtesy of Vox Day, who coined the line, if pro wrestling looked this fake, no one would watch. I mean, he was bound and determined to be, he was going to be the nominee, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the Democratic side, they have not yet determined who the designated winner is going to be, although, based on what's happening this weekend with the sudden discovery, we are shocked, I say, to discover these sermons by Reverend Jeremiah Wright. I think the big comeback portion of Hillary Clinton's pre-scripted mm-hmm. run to the White House has now begun.
Yeah, I think so, too. I really do. You know, Barack Obama, he has waged, and I'll use that word because that I think that's an appropriate word when it comes to campaigning. He's waged an amazing campaign against Hillary, but I don't know. He seemed to come out of nowhere and become this phenomenon.
Right.
And I think with many age groups, he still is.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you watch him speak, and you I even feel this too when I watch him speak. There's something about him.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I start to feel that way, I slap myself, literally just slap myself, and say, snap out of it.
We've been doing a lot of slapping lately.
Oh, gosh.
Because he is a compelling speaker. There is no question about it. But the timing of the release of the information of Jeremiah Wright's sermons is more mm-hmm. intriguing than the content of those sermons because
right.
his beliefs have not been a secret. In fact, there was an article in Rolling Stone magazine about a year ago that brought up all of these, mm-hmm. you know, Afrocentric beliefs mm-hmm. of Jeremiah Wright. And it is, you know, his defenders are trying to portray this as just, you know, it's the same thing as John McCain accepting the endorsement of John Hagee. Difference being, of course, that Hagee endorsed McCain, whereas Obama, by attending Reverend Wright's church for 20 years, was endorsing Reverend
exactly.
Wright.
Exactly. That's
for,
exactly it.
For us to believe that Barack Obama attended his church regularly for 20 years and never heard anything like what we're seeing on YouTube and on
which
the news
which is exactly
now,
what he says.
Which is exactly what he says. Just it is like, you know, come on now. Come on now. You know, we're not stupid. You know, come on. Let's get real. So I think what we're seeing is his campaign beginning to fade because I really, really doubt that many voters will watch much of Jeremiah Wright and connect him to Obama 20 years in the church pews in a favorable light. In addition, by the way, it's just come out that the Obama campaign admitted, oh, yeah, by the way, we did take a lot more money from the indicted
Resco?
Anthony Resco than we thought. It wasn't $70,000. It was $250,000.
Yeah,
we just
but honestly,
about
we
that.
Gave it back. And so, we feel sick about it.
But
let's take a left turn, though. Let's
sure,
go off on
yeah.
another tangent because we've done plenty with politics.
Amen.
There are stories coming out of WorldNet Daily. If you haven't seen the story that was posted there on Saturday, Friday and Saturday, about the demonic possession case,
mm-hmm.
you really, really need to read it.
Yeah, it's a case that was documented by a board-certified psychologist with plenty of witnesses of a woman who spoke in unnatural voices and made sounds that mm-hmm. The observers felt could not normally be made by a human voice box, by a human throat. But beyond that, they witnessed her levitate. I mean, that's not the cool. I mean, that's not the scary stuff.
Exactly.
The freaky stuff was that she was levitating 6 feet off
exactly.
the bed.
Exactly. And these are the kinds
six
of things
off
that
the bed.
Russ Dizdar
yes.
has been telling us for a long time. And this is why I want people to read this, because this is not written by a pastor.
No.
This is not, these are not the accounts and observations of pastors or exorcists.
And this isn't coming from, as many critics would you know, try to characterize cases of demonic possession and exorcisms. This isn't the kind of thing that happened in a you know, in some far off superstitious third world country or in the deep south with a bunch of charismatics who are trying to, you know, inflate things and attach every human weakness to a demon. No, this was a board certified psychiatrist who's a professor of clinical psychiatry at New York Medical College.
Right.
So it's been documented. It's published in the New Oxford Review. And WorldNet Daily has a story on it, but this woman levitated 6 inches off the ground. Objects flew around the room, and again was witnessed by a team of priests, deacons, lay assistants, and many of whom also had medical and psychiatric training. So it is a very compelling case that documents that this sort of stuff does still happen, even in our modern age of medicine and psychiatry.
It not only still happens, I would argue that it is on the rise
mm-hmm.
and is becoming more bold in its presentation. There was a time when this sort of activity did take place, primarily in third world countries. And the argument there, of course, as you say, was, well, they believe in these superstitious things and, you know, they can't explain something that we could explain scientifically. Or they're just plain exaggerating and or lying. These things are starting to occur in so-called civilized mm-hmm. areas of the world. The West
yeah.
is seeing it happen all over the place. And I think it's because we are getting down to the wire here. We're approaching the very last, literally the last days, weeks, and months before the last 7 years that some people refer to as the tribulation. It's the final week of the Daniel prophecy. It's the last chance for people to get to know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. We're coming up on those last hours of the world as we know it.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we continue to talk to Russ Dizdar and others who are in the same line of work. There are a couple people we've talked to who prefer not to be interviewed but do the same sort of work. You know, it is a it's not going to be a pleasant ride, let's put it that way, but there are things coming. And again, as we see these signs, we're reminded that Jesus said, you know, look for the signs and you know, be aware so that you are not taken off guard. And we take comfort and find joy in seeing these signs. I mean, not in that these terrible things are happening, but that we see them as evidence that the promised return mm-hmm. is coming and coming soon. There was a review of the show that was posted to the internet some time back in which we were accused of being victims of crushing paranoia. And we joke about, you know, having the wall of paranoia and so forth. And we do talk about a lot of dark things. And we make no bones about the fact that we live in a world surrounded by beings that we can't see,
mm-hmm.
Who influence the things that we do see. But that doesn't mean we're afraid, and it doesn't mean we are, you know, looking for a demon under every pillow or under every rock. But it's just the signs that we try to analyze and discern what's happening around us, and
exactly.
that's what's going on.
There's a spiritual battle going on all around us, and you know what? And the reason we talk about politics so much is not just because there are events there that we can discern and how they relate to the prophetic timeline that we see in the Bible, but also because those manifested events are rooted in a supernatural battle that we can't see with our human eyes.
Most of the time. Sometimes
Most of
there
the
are
time.
Little things that peek through, like the case of the woman.
There are things like that, exactly, yeah. And they do come through. And I think as we get closer and closer to that event, we're told in the Bible that when Satan is cast down to earth, he is very angry and he goes after mankind with a vengeance because he knows he has very little time left.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that, let's face it, the inhabitants of that unseen world, be they demons or fallen angels, whatever you want to call them, They are well aware of Scripture, far more than you and I are.
Yeah.
And they know that we're coming down to the wire, and that's why it's starting to really, you know, ramp up, just like Christ said when he said it's like a woman going into labor. Those pains are going to get closer and closer mm-hmm. together, and they're going to become more and more intense. We're seeing that in the supernatural battle.
Right. So we got the woman who levitated, spoke other languages, and threw stuff around the room without touching them in Pennsylvania, just across the Pennsylvania border from Russ Dizdar and his mm-hmm. home church and his ministry. State police there found three dogs hanging and burned over a pile of burning tires. This is southeast of Pittsburgh. This is not in the Pennsylvania Dutch country that we've talked about before, around Lititz, Pennsylvania.
No, it isn't.
This is actually near an area of Pennsylvania where my ancestors lived for a while back in the 1780s. The key point about the hanged dogs, though, being burnt, was that there was a pentagram on the ground around the tires. Mm-hmm. One of the dogs reportedly was a German Shepherd mix weighing about 75 pounds. Police are convinced because of the weight of the dogs, because they were big, that more than one person was involved in hoisting these dogs up into the air by ropes. In addition, there's another case out of Pennsylvania, Tullytown, which is in the eastern side of Pennsylvania now. I don't think we've talked about this because it's been a while since we blathered, but back in February, some churches there just outside Philadelphia were vandalized in Bucks County. That's north of Philadelphia. Incidentally, the setting for the movie Signs, Bucks County.
Mm-hmm.
That's where M. Night Shyamalan is from. Three houses there around Levittown, Pennsylvania, have been defaced with satanic graffiti, basically, mm-hmm. and vandalized. So, isolated incidents, some people will write this stuff off as the work of, teenagers acting out.
Exactly.
But we believe that even if they're just acting out, instead of acting according to a set ritual mm-hmm. or a working, are being influenced by forces that they may not even realize.
Very much so. The reason that we take note of any stories that come along in the news regarding dogs who have been abused, especially dogs who have been hung, is because if you've listened to any of our interviews with Peter Lavenda, you're aware of the Process Church. And gosh, we talked with, who else do we talk about the Process Church with? Probably several people. The Process Church often had these same kind of events going on mm-hmm. wherever the Process Church had meetings. You would see dogs that were involved, and they were hung. In fact, they had a lot of German Shepherds around them at all times.
Yeah.
But you would find mistreatment and murders involving German Shepherds, and literally they would be hanged from trees. Of course, we've got the Son of Sam, who – many believe was involved in the Process Church, mm-hmm. and David, last name is just escaping me. The
Berkowitz.
Son of Sam Berkowitz. Thank you very much. He claimed that others were responsible for some of those killings, and of course, the Son of Sam, was a dog, mm-hmm. according to the spin that was in all of
Doberman,
the papers.
Wasn't it?
Was he a Doberman or was it a German Shepherd?
One or the other. Again, there was the link there to the Process Church of the Final Judgment.
Right.
Which, again, linked to Charlie Manson. Dave McGowan, I think, was the other fellow that we talked
about. Dave McGowan,
about his,
absolutely.
About his
and of course, Peter Lavenda, we've joked many times that his books are the 6 degrees of Charlie Manson.
Manson, right.
Yeah.
What's really creepy, by the way, as a side note to the Process Church and its connection to German Shepherds and the sacrificed dogs that were discovered out in California in the years leading up to the Manson murders, the ex-members of the Process Church formed in 1986 the Best Friends Animal Society, mm-hmm. which is an animal welfare rescue group.
Well, I find that very curious. And again, we cannot say with any kind of certainty that they have continued their Process Church ways, but I just find it really interesting that that's where they went.
Yeah, very, very curious. A story that's coming out that we need to talk about here as we get into the supernatural side of the battle and the evil worked by those unseen by human eyes, a story that is getting no attention at all in the U.S. press but is big news over in the U.K. is the cleanup of a children's home located on the island of Jersey. Now, Jersey is one of the Channel Islands. It's located about 10, 12 miles off the coast of France, Normandy, about 100 miles southeast of England. And there was a children's home there that was closed in 1986. And it has now finally come out 20 years later that at least 160 victims have come forward and accused the former operators and owners of this children's home of torture, rape, abuse. There is a what the UK police are calling a cellar of sex horror that has been uncovered. Areas of a cellar underneath this building that were bricked up. They've gone in there. They've discovered the skull of a child in there. They've discovered bloodstains and shackles in this cellar. And now suddenly this island of Jersey, which has about 85,000, 90,000 residents, is in the news in England. And fingers are being pointed all over the place because this abuse, some of the victims, the victims, alleged victims, are in their 60s and 70s and say that, yes, when I was there, this sort of thing was routine. So this went on for decades, and supposedly nobody knew about it.
Well, they did report it. And I think that's one of the big parts of the scandal is because it's now believed based on evidence that the local constabulary in on the island of Jersey, and Jersey is not, it's sort of an odd little governmental setup. They are, as I understand it, actually directly under the sovereignty of the Queen. But they do have their own local government. They're not part of the EU, along with England and Scotland and Ireland. They are sort of on their own. They're close to France. I think they've changed, you know, allegiances over the thousand or so years between France and England. They were even, Jersey was even occupied by the Germans
during World War II
from around 1940 to 1945. And this home, this children's home that we're talking about, is not a place that was, it was almost like a punishment home. And I don't mean that simply because of what we're hearing about the things that were done to the kids. One of the stories that I read was that, well, a young man was told by his tormentor, what do you expect? Your parents don't care about you. Your family doesn't care about you. No one cares about you. You're here because you were truant all the time. You're here to be punished.
Yeah, and there are some even wilder accusations that are coming out that we won't get into about this. We're not sure the news sources yet.
I guess what I'm saying is that these kids weren't necessarily orphans.
No.
They were, it was almost like it was a girls' school or a boys' school. Those are terms that that I know here in Indiana, because when I was growing up, there was what was called girls' school or boys' school. And it was really for kids that were unruly and their parents didn't know what to do with them. And so they sent them off there to be, you know, straightened out.
Right. And so the stories are coming out and the revelations, the accusations. No one's been charged yet as far as we know. But again, what's really, you know, what's really disturbing is that accusations, you know, by these former children residents at this home,
and even
that they
getting
were being
into
drugged.
The accusations of being taken out to sea.
Being taken out to sea on yachts and used
by wealthy, you know.
Wealthy pedophiles.
Wealthy pedophiles. That is the accusation.
And this, again, fits into the pattern that was discussed with Dave McGowan. His one of the sections of his book, Program to Kill, was called The Pedophocracy. You can find that available online, and I'll put a link to it, because it fits with a pattern of an underground trade in children, essentially, in basically global, that occasionally pops up, makes the news for a short while, very sensational story again like this, and then disappears again because you and I, just finding it really horrific to contemplate such things, just don't want to hear about this. We don't want to know about it. And that's what these perpetrators count on. Why do we bring this up? Is it more than just a sensationalist story? Yeah, I think so, because again, as we talk about many times here, the abuse of children, especially sexual abuse of children, is a key component in many magical workings. Aleister Crowley was a believer in breaking down sexual taboos, and the more horrifying the taboo, the greater the sexual, or the greater the magical power that was generated from performing the act. And it sounds sensationalistic. It sounds like you know, we're bringing it up to make for a better broadcast.
But no, this not is, at this all. Is something in fact, that's documented. There are details that we simply won't go into because we try to tell you what we need to without sensationalizing an event. I mean, there are so many details. You can read them for yourselves mm-hmm. when you get in there. But the truth is that another aspect of this sort of behavior with kids is mind control. And if you can traumatize a child at a very early age, then you can split that child off into four, you know, multiple personalities mm-hmm. and take each of those personalities and create a different persona that can then later be used for espionage or, you know, personal gratification, yeah. assassinations.
Right.
Yeah. Without front person who is there for the world to see. And Russ Dizdar has talked about that a number of times mm-hmm. when we've had him on. And it makes me wonder if maybe something like that could have been going on there as well.
That's very possible. That's very possible.
Well, when you look at the fact that it's not under the direct auspices of the UK, mm-hmm. it's sort of on its own out there,
right.
a little island.
Sort of like the island of Aruba in the case we saw with Natalie Holloway.
Yes.
What were the main complaints that the Holloway family had? It's that the police there and the judicial system were all connected to the wealthy and powerful, mm-hmm. and it was the children, the sons of a couple of the wealthy, influential members of the community that were the prime suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And so they met a lot of resistance. That is apparently what's happening here in this case in Jersey. One of the lead investigator has said that he's been threatened with having his home and his car burned if he doesn't drop the investigation. He's meeting resistance from former members of the police forces who either are ashamed or perhaps resent the fact that their reputations are being tarnished because they didn't pursue and prosecute this case years ago, or they want to cover up the fact that they were perhaps complicit mm-hmm. in covering this up. So it's who knows where this is going to go. But again, because of Ballot Bowl 08, and now that we've got March Madness here and baseball season about to start here in the United States, we are blissfully unaware of all of this. And this is the kind of thing that most Americans would deny even happens, even when, again, it occasionally pops up in our news.
Well, the baseball season, I can understand.
So and this is something that does need to be looked at because in the UK, this is really a big story. We will link to it. Elsewhere in the UK, by the way, we see a couple more stories of teens found hanged in Wales, a couple hanged in North Wales this time over the last couple of weeks. Not close to Bridge End, which was the subject of our broadcast with Russ Dizdar a few weeks ago.
There's also a story of a young man who was found dead in Swansea.
Now, Swansea is
Bridge End. And it's a curious story. The cause of death has not yet been determined, according to the sources that I read today. But this young man lived in a house with six other people. He was a student. Handsome young man, very liked, you know. Lived with six other people and had been missing for 4 days and was discovered inside the house that he shared with six other people.
That sounds a little
implausible.
4 days
after he was last seen. Doesn't that sound odd?
Yeah, it sounds a little implausible.
Yeah. So I'm trying to keep an eye on that, and if I learn anything more about that, I will let you know.
Well, tomorrow morning, Monday, the 17th of March, the of course, St. Patrick's Day. We look for some interesting financial news to come out of the U.S., changing gears just again. Don't be surprised if we see Bear Stearns actually mm-hmm. fold. And this is a big deal because the words bank failure have not really been mentioned in the press.
Huge. We've got Bear Stearns behind them. We've also got some other banks that may be lining up. The Carlyle Fund.
Yeah, tied to the Carlyle
Group. Is in bad shape. Drake Fund is in bad shape.
Yeah. Well, the Carlyle Fund is basically, it's going to be liquidated. It's done mm-hmm. for. Bear Stearns may be done for, despite the evidence of a bailout on Friday. The thing that is really annoying about the announcement that the Fed was going to intervene in the case of Bear Stearns is that we see the American taxpayer is going to be put on the hook for the malfeasance of these guys at Bear Stearns.
And the IMF has recommended that the governments who are member governments and are facing this sort of domino effect in their own home turf, that they use, quote, public funds
mm-hmm. yeah.
to bail them out.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve, through many years of cheap credit, put a lot of money into circulation by putting it in the hands of investors who found it was in their best interest. Look, if we only have to pay 1% or 2% back to the Fed to take this money, we can turn around and loan it out to people at, through credit cards at anywhere from 18 to 30%, or put it into mortgages, which then they can leverage by taking a whole bunch of mortgages and creating what they call CDOs, which are, we're getting into high finance here, which I barely understand, but mortgage-backed securities, MBS.
Falling asleep over here.
Yeah. and they essentially turn just a few loans into collateral for other loans. The reason that the Carlyle Fund, for example, went under is that they were leveraged at a ratio of like 32 to 1. In other words, they took 10 bucks and they used it to borrow like 320, banking on being able to convert that $320 worth of loans into even more money that they could use to pay. Well, as property values began to drop, the value of their securities began to collapse. As I understand it, and again, I just have barely understand it, but the house of cards that is the world credit market right now was essentially built on making stuff up, literally making stuff up, because a lot of these financial instruments that were traded back and forth by speculators in a global market of about $500 trillion, which is 10 times bigger than the whole world's gross domestic product put together, it consists of stuff that they don't even know. They don't know the true value of it. They just don't know. They make a stab at it, and then they trade it back and forth. It's like I said, you might as well be trading baseball cards.
It's the kind of stuff that you would have been sent to prison for 10 years ago.
Exactly. And now the Fed will bail you out if you're on your last ropes. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we'll watch for that tomorrow. Speaking of tomorrow, I will be the guest on a podcast called Eerie Radio, E-E-R-I-E, which is a paranormal podcast based out of Indiana. In fact, just up the road here, just a hop to the left. And we talked about the Divine Council and the spiritual war going on around us, and how that relates to paranormal investigations and ghosts and EVPs and things like that. Once again, I tended to blather.
I was privileged to hear this end of that conversation, and I highly recommend this. You really need to listen to this podcast. No, the people at Erie don't come at it from the same spiritual warfare viewpoint that we do, but they are looking at something that is very real. And I think that's why we have, there was a time when I was uncomfortable, honestly, with interviewing people who didn't take the Christian perspective on these events. But the truth is, I think if you go to these various sources as witnesses, it's just more supportive evidence that what we see as Christians really is taking place.
Yep.
It's just we're privileged to have the explanation for it through the Bible.
Yeah, and the historic evidence that supports the truth of the Bible and the truth claims
and again,
of Christianity.
And, don't be afraid to look into those dark places. There is nothing that takes place in our world that cannot be explained through Scripture.
Absolutely right. And Ben and Seth and Gina, the hosts of Erie Radio, were very gracious, and they're approaching it with open minds. And interestingly enough, we often find that people like them who are interested in the paranormal and not necessarily Christian are more open to seeking evidence-based answers than people who are in church every Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm. I know that. Well, you know what? We're going to have to go because we're running out of time.
But meanwhile, we can discuss this in the forum anytime you like. Stop by. You'll find the link at PIDradio.com. And next week, of course, God willing, we will have Dr. Jerome Corsi talking about the impending North American Union and perhaps following that, the Transatlantic Economic Council.
That's right.
Until next time, email addresses, Derek at peeringintodarkness.com.
Mine would be Sharon at peeringintodarkness.com. And as Derek said, we will be putting that interview with Dr. Corsi up on, God willing, on Friday evening. And, of course, he and I will be off this weekend, heading down to see my family, going to have a good time there. We'll try to make the statement on Friday, but just in case we don't, have a wonderful week this week, everybody. Remember that Jesus Christ died for your sins and my sins, and that there is no reason why you can't have a magnificent eternal life with Jesus Christ. All you have to do is realize that you need him. You are a sinner, that he paid the price for those sins. And you just need to accept that free gift. That's all. You just have to believe it.
Amen.
Pretty
to
easy,
that.
Huh?
Amen to that. Until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.